This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
On my podcast, Aspire with Emma Greed, we share the keys to succeed in business and in life. Listen to and follow Aspire with Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the best food scenes in the country, right here in Minnesota. And nobody knows it like magazine food critic and James Beard Award finalist, Jason DeRusha. Now bringing you the most interesting people and hottest trends. Let's listen in as DeRusha eats.
Hey everyone, it's Jason DeRusha. So glad to have you with me for a very special episode of DeRusha Eats. Today, an extended interview with a Twin Cities chef who has grown into a different person and is at the same time, staying true and reconnecting with a heritage that he never directly knew. Same Wadi opened a restaurant called Saffron when he was just a young man in his low 20s. He ended up on the Food Network on Iron Chef competing against Morimoto. He was as hot as they came at that young age. And he shook up the Twin Cities dining scene in a way that maybe we didn't have our arms around fully at that time. The year was 2007. The hot trend was the gastropub, so sort of a fancy burger joint. And in comes this 24-year-old with a white tablecloth, Mediterranean restaurant, a chef with Palestinian heritage who said, nope, I'm doing it my way. I'm introducing halloumi and ras el hanout and things that we couldn't find at a grocery store. Most of us had to look in a dictionary to try to figure out what it was. Same ran Saffron for a decade. He wrote a cookbook. He achieved great success. He launched a food truck called World Street Kitchen. And then, after about 10 years of that white tablecloth restaurant, decided to shut it down. World Street is still open as a brick-and-mortar restaurant. Same runs an ice cream company called Milk Jam Creamery. But he has just announced that he's bringing back Saffron. I've never heard of it before. Someone who put a restaurant to bed, let it sleep for 8 years, and then decides, you know what? It's time to bring that baby back to life. Same shares his story as to how he landed at the decision, what he's looking for, what he expects Saffron today to look like. And we also talk about his identity as a Palestinian, the politics of being Palestinian in Minnesota. It's a fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoy it as you sit back and listen to Same Wadi on DeRusha Eats.
Our guest on DeRusha Eats is a friend of mine, an incredible chef, a terrific human being. Same Wadi, it's so good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
People know you for World Street Kitchen, for Milk Jam Creamery, and there is a strong emotional connection with the restaurant you opened when you were essentially a child, Saffron. How old were you when you first opened your own place in Minneapolis?
Well, I'm 23 now, so I opened. Well, let's say no. I'm 40 years old now, so I opened it when I was 23. I act like I'm 23 right now, so I feel like when I opened it, I was probably acted like I was 13.
Were you
as an absolute child?
Did you feel that way? I mean, when you open your own thing at such a young age, and you opened it with your brother. But did you feel like you were really young, or were you sort of trying to act like an older, mature guy?
I've always had to act older than my age ever since I was a child. And so the idea...
Why is that? Why did...
Just being born in the circumstances that I was born in.
Yeah.
you know, you sort of, I went through war when I was 7 years old. I come from a family of people that were exiled from their homeland and so on and so forth. So the idea of just living your life normally was never an option for me. And I moved to the States when I was probably 14 years old or something like that. And I knew that there was, you know, sort of a movement that I needed to always act older than I am. I needed to do certain things and make sure that I'm staying ahead of the curve. And when I opened Saffron, I was the youngest person in my kitchen.
Crazy, right?
It is.
How did you, from that circumstance, how did you lead? How did you lead that group?
It was really interesting because there was a lot of talent in that kitchen when we first opened. At the time, a lot of really fine dining restaurants were shutting down and we were like opening up. So I got like...
It was sort of gastropub era, right?
Yes. You remember that time where like Lavon closed, Five closed, D'Amico just closed. You know, yeah, all of these restaurants had like very talented people that were out of jobs. And I was lucky because then I just absorbed all of them. And, you know, I had sous chefs working as line cooks for lunch. And so it was a lot of energy, a lot of opinionated chefs, a lot
sure.
of talent.
Because of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I loved it because I was speaking a different language than all of them. So I sort of commanded respect in that regard because they were speaking the sort of Eurocentric, you know, vision of what food is. And all of a sudden I'm showing them this whole new language, this whole new alphabet of spices and different ingredients and what have you. And they are excited about it, right?
Mm.
And so...
And you authentically had that as part of your upbringing, because your parents fled Palestine, settled in Kuwait. You were born in Kuwait.
I was, yes.
And then you came here in 97?
Yeah, with a short stint in Jordan at the time.
Jordan.
Like 7 years in Jordan.
But the flavor palette that you grew up with is so different. I mean, I don't know if people really can place themselves in the early 2000s in the Twin Cities, but French cooking... And those ingredients, that was pretty much it.
That was it. I mean, it was French and Italian. There was one else doing anything different. You know, I think Tim McKee might have been the only chef that I knew that spoke that language.
He brought some of the Spanish Mediterranean
flavors. I remember he made tagine one day when I was working at Solera. And I just remember, like, stopping in my tracks. And I'm like, oh, he... knows how to cook.
Yeah.
Like, this is real cooking. This isn't just searing a piece of fish and putting it over a puree and, you know, shaving truffles on it. Like,
right.
Tagine requires talent. It, you know, you're babying this dish. You're sort of, it's moving with you. You're having to layer spices. You're having to do all these things. I'm like, wow, this is, I'm in the right place right now. So, but in general, most of the chefs and cooks that were in the cities didn't know this food. So I had to sort of teach everybody the alphabet, the basics of what these flavors are. And then all of a sudden, like by the time that we'd closed, everybody's using preserved lemons. Everyone has got, you know, Ras Al Hanout on the menu or Seven Spice or, you know, people are talking about kofta meatballs as if they're, you know, a thing that
right.
they
Everyone
grew up with.
This.
You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
So it was great. And halloumi was on the menu at different places where we had to bring in halloumi from like Cyprus, right? Like
because you couldn't get it from one of the distributors.
Yeah.
And are there other, when in that time, are there other ingredients or flavors or things where you were like, you either had to teach the distributor to bring it in for you or you had to bring in directly?
There were so many of those moments where right now I wish, you know, this is a part of like why I want to reopen this restaurant because now I'm like, I went to the grocery store and I saw freake,
yeah.
a Palestinian, you know, wheat product that is like hulled green wheat that is burned. And that's, it gets like this really nice charred smoky flavor that I literally talk to multiple farmers to like,
could you grow this?
Grow it for me. And that's what they did.
Wow.
In you know, the late
Isn't that funny?
2000s. Yeah. And then now I'm like at the grocery store
oh,
and
yeah.
they sell it. And it's
I
like,
had a
what?
Dietitian from Kowalski's on my show when I was on TV, and she was talking about freaky. And you're like,
that's freaky.
Yeah, it is freaky. That's right. Sabe Wadi is our guest. You heard a little bit of the news there that Sabe broke just really over the last couple of weeks. That you have decided against all logical advice from anyone in the restaurant world.
I am not a logical person. Let's be real.
You are going to do something that I've been racking my brain to try to think if there's another example of someone who has dipped back into a restaurant that they opened, closed, and then after, what's it been, 15, 18 years?
Eight years. Well, I opened it. Yeah, I opened it 18 years ago.
18 years ago. It's been closed for eight.
Yeah, it was then, operating for 10.
And you really explain kind of how you arrived at the decision to sort of go back to your culinary home.
That's a great question. And I think to answer it, it was more of a journey. I knew once we closed the restaurant that it was the right thing to do for my career at the time. But we closed it at a time that it was operating well.
Business was fine.
Business was great. It was doing really good financially for the first time, you know.
Because it takes
a really long time. And at
often
this point,
5 years like, yeah, for a new restaurant.
Exactly. And at this point, we were clipping well. We were doing things that I was proud of in terms of the food, the service. The bar program was something that was like one of the earliest bar programs in the city that was led by some of the most amazing talent in the city. And so we had something that was like really special, and I knew that, but I was tired. I was really, really tired because I'd been at that point, you know, burning myself out for 10 straight years.
How many, you know, at that age when you're building something, when you're running your own kitchen, it's your own restaurant, what is a typical work week for a chef in that scenario?
So the first 5 years in business, I worked 6 to 7 days a week. I would go into the restaurant somewhere between 8 or 9 a.m. and I would leave probably 11 p.m. or if it was the weekend, I would leave around 1 a.m.
Crazy.
Yes. Yep. And I did it without the help of any drugs. I was sober.
You were sober.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Which is also like
just
insane.
Staying awake, staying energetic, staying healthy. But I remember you near the end of that run and you didn't look like yourself. I mean, you could see the punishment that you had exerted on your own body.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was hard. It was really, really hard. And operating at that level that we were operating, we had to sort of really work hard to make sure that we're operating at that level. It wasn't like we couldn't phone it in. Everybody had to show up. Everybody had to like put in their all to make this restaurant work because it was a hard restaurant to operate. And I just couldn't see myself in that actual space for 10 more years. That's where like it became very evident that that physical space, I'd outgrown that space, that energy, that neighborhood, things of that nature. And so once we closed it, like the idea of reopening it immediately within 6 months went back into my head. And in 20...
You missed it?
I did. I missed having a space that I could speak the language very easily. I would walk into the kitchen and not know what's going to go on the menu. I would just start to cook and things would come naturally. Right, like I would come in, I would have ingredients, I would have farmers or purveyors bring me certain things and we would just start cooking. And that was like we had a menu of like 6 to 8 dishes that were daily or sometimes weekly changing just based on the ingredients that were dropped off in our back door. And so I missed that from a creative outlet.
Sure.
But also I missed the idea of having a home kitchen that I could then have friends over, hosting people in my dining room. Not that I'm not able to do that at World Street Kitchen or a Milk Jam, because they're just a different speed. You know, we're like, when we're talking about these things at Milk Jam, like people come in and I do samples with them and we talk about the journey of the flavors and things of that nature. It brings me back to that.
You feel that.
Yeah.
It's about the connection.
Connection, exactly.
But World Street Kitchen is a fast casual concept, huge flavor, delicious stuff, but it's not, you're not going to have like, I mean, people celebrate occasions there.
They do, yeah.
But it's not the same as what you
Correct.
Think of in a sit-down restaurant.
Correct, absolutely.
But
and
you
it's
missed
like,
it.
I missed that, so therefore, you know, if I missed it, then definitely other people miss it. And that was always my philosophy about food. Like, if I think something is delicious, other people probably think that is delicious. You know, so yeah. Like if I can make food that is delicious to me that I crave, that means other people are going to like it, most right. likely. I've been wrong a couple of times with hash browns, I guess.
It was very craveable.
It was very craveable.
All right, let's stop right there. We'll come back with the first negative review I ever wrote in my life about Same's hash browns. They were delicious. I'll tell you what I didn't like. We'll pick it up there. We'll talk about the fact that Same certainly doesn't hold a grudge from something that, how many years ago did I write that? Well,
it felt like it was yesterday.
We'll pick up the conversation and the journey. Saffron going to reopen as Same looks for a spot, a language of food that he's speaking, and more in this conversation on DeRussia Eats.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of casino-style games like bingo, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
On my podcast, Aspire with Emma Greed, we share the keys to succeed in business and in life. Listen to and follow Aspire with Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
DeRussia Eats continues. Here's your host, Jason DeRussia.
Same Wadi is our guest. Same, I want you to share a little bit about your family story, because people may know the Wadi family. Holy Land is, these are your relatives, right?
Their cousins, yes.
They're cousins. And you've always worked with your older brother, much older.
Much, much older. Thank you for that.
Much older, much, you know, maybe, is he nicer than you?
Is that even a question to ask? Of course he's nicer. Yeah, he's the nicer.
He's a very nice man.
Yeah. I mean, that's what happens when you're, you know, just a nice guy that's old, you know?
He is a nice old man.
He is.
He ran the front of house at Saffron. You two have been business partners at World Street. Syed arrived in the U.S. Like 6 years before you, right?
Yeah, something along those lines.
But what was your childhood like here in the Twin Cities? Were you in Minneapolis or St. Paul, or where'd you guys come?
We moved into a first-ring suburb, okay. New Brighton.
Oh, yeah.
So I was going to school in New Brighton, but working and spending all of my time in South Minneapolis.
Oh, wow.
Because my family had a little bodega there. And so I worked on 38th and Nicollet for so many years. And that's where, like, I learned English. I spoke English before I got here, but that's where I learned, like...
You learned the real people
English. The real people English. Yeah. I wasn't saying water anymore, you know what I mean? So, I spent like my entire first summer there. And so I had like this completely different world view of like the suburbs and the inner city mixed together.
Oh, so interesting.
Oh my God, it was so confusing. As a 13, 14-year-old kid, you're like, what am I doing? And how could something be so polar opposite?
Because New Brighton... Certainly in the, like, late 90s, early, like, there were not a lot of Palestinians.
Oh, there wasn't a lot of anything other than...
A dark, like, suntan was about all you got in New Brighton.
I mean, not even that. Yeah, that was right. Also illegal. Italians were not allowed.
No Italians. No Greeks.
Yeah, that was really...
But then you went to South Minneapolis and were like, oh...
And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm the lightest person here right now.
Right.
Yeah. And it was like the cultural differences were also so huge that it showed me two different Americas, right? I'd never seen that before. And so my worldview was just of this one homogenous United States. And then all of a sudden I'm living here for the first year and I'm experiencing two completely different worlds, different language, different food items, different family values, in a sense.
Sure.
Just whole different
music,
world.
Different culture,
everything.
Different.
And I was fully submerged in both of them.
And you were
half and half, and I was confused.
12 like, miles
where
away.
Where do I sit in all of this?
Where do you think you do sit?
I didn't fit in either one of those equations. And so like I had to sort of forge this place for myself and sort of take a little bit from here and a little bit from here and mix them together.
Interesting. Do you think that impacted the way that you ended up exploring food?
I think my identity as a human has been sort of this idea of being connected to a place through my ancestors and not having a place that I'm connected to today. And so that when I moved to this country, it was a really interesting conversation that I had with my brother. And I lived with him for a few months while my parents just kind of got the things ready and moved back into the States. And he said to me, listen, like, you can do anything in this country. You can literally be, a scientist, an engineer, whatever you want to be, a doctor. And you could be a drug dealer, a street guy. You could be just a total, person that has no value added to this community. But I want you to know one thing. Most of the people that you will meet, you will be the first Palestinian that they meet. So please be a positive role model for people. Which sat with me for years. As a 14-year-old kid, to hear those words, to have that weight on your shoulders, wow.
That's intense.
Very. Till this day, I think about those words.
Do you still feel that pressure?
100%. And today more than ever.
Because of what's going on in Gaza and the Middle East.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's like my existence is sort of, where people ask me, where are you from? That question is such a loaded question that I know I could answer it a few different ways.
Huh. How do you decide how to answer it?
Depends on where I am and how much coffee I've had for the day.
I mean, that's real, right?
Like, I mean, honestly, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who's born here in the United States, it's something I never have to think of. And certainly, like, I'm not born, in an area where people have, very emotional and passionate reactions right now.
Right, right. And it was, for me, it was the choice of having my identity as a Palestinian and connecting it with my identity as an American and answering that question, like, I'm from Palestine, but my family was exiled, right? So, like, I was born in Kuwait, but I have zero connection to Kuwait. I lived in Jordan, but I have very little connection to Jordan. Other than my roots being in that region, I am American. Right? I identify as a Minnesotan. I wear shorts in the winter.
Right.
But
really, that's the foundation of your growth as Sameh, as a person, is as a Minnesotan, as an American.
Absolutely.
But there's something in your heart that draws you back to your family's ancestral.
I mean, I think that's the same for anybody. I mean,
I don't know. I don't know if it's as maybe, I mean, because you've gone back, you've explored.
Yeah, I was not allowed to go. I was not allowed to go for years. I was denied entry multiple times. And the last and only time that I've been there, I was held at the border for 6 hours and questioned as an American citizen that is just there to vacation. And so there's something very, very political about just me being born to Palestinian parents.
Yeah, that's real.
And I don't have to say anything or do anything. I just say, my parents were born here, and everybody.
That's that.
That's it. Yep. That's actually a question that they asked me at the border. Where was your father born? Where was his father born? And my answer to both of them was here.
Yeah.
Well, what part? And I'm like, I don't know.
Right.
I wasn't around.
Wow.
And so when somebody asks me, like, where are you from? That lineage of seven generations of Palestinians that comes in, that is where I'm from. That's, you know, when Italian Americans talk about it, you know, they talk about their Italian roots and people are proud of it. It shouldn't be a thing that people bat an eye on.
Right.
But I have seven generations that I can date back to the village that my parents or my father was born in. That's where my roots are. And I don't know if many people have that much roots in a place.
Right.
So when we inherently talk about my past, there is a connection that is with the land that is also with me as a person, because that's the growth that comes from those roots. You can transplant those roots, just like a lot of fruit trees and vegetables are transplanted across the world. I was transplanted and put here. It doesn't change the fact that, like, I am Palestinian and I am American at the same time, much like a lot of the wine-growing regions in the United States, right?
Right.
These roots did not come from this country. They came from other countries.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this country so beautiful, is that we all have different roots.
Right.
And we can share these stories. And at the end of the day, that doesn't make me any less, you know, enthusiastic to be living in this country.
Right. Yeah. It's so interesting. I'm so glad you went there. It's such a fascinating reality when you are from, you know, a part of the world where, even though your memory is not necessarily of, you didn't grow up there, but there is something about the fact that that cultivar was in the ground. And so it's always a part of you. Sameh Wadi is our guest here on DeRussia Eats. We're almost out of time. For the radio portion of our conversation, we'll continue this in our podcast on DeRussia Eats, which you can find everywhere you get podcasts. But before we go, we always ask our guests to give three restaurant recommendations. Don't have to be the best restaurants in the world, but three places you love going. What is number one?
Oh, that's a great question. Okay. I'm obsessed with Caspian Bistro. That's one of my favorite
places.
Right
by the U of M.
Yes. One of the most consistent restaurants in the world, I think. I've been eating there since I was 13.
Beautiful Same food. Order. Great people.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Get the Cuba Day. Thank me later. Send me thank you letters, love letters, all of that stuff. It's amazing.
Number two.
Dario. Dario, he's doing amazing things.
Joe Raleigh.
Amazing.
North Loop.
We
Italian.
Need him to chill a little bit, but like the guy is a talented cook, and I think the food is really, really special.
Really
there.
Good.
And then the third spot, I would give it up to Pho 79.
Ah, excellent.
I love that spot. It's like my hiding place where I go eat by myself at like 10 a.m. and just, you know, don't talk to anybody and just eat a bowl of pho.
Right on Nicollet?
Yes.
Like 20, that's the one. In between 25th yes, and 26th?
Thank you for that point. Yeah, yeah. The Minneapolis location, not the St. Paul location. No shade at the St. Paul location, but we mad shade on St. Paul.
A little bit of shade. A little bit of shade. Sameh, we appreciate it. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Jason DeRussia with a message from Minnesota's pig farmers. Discover the meat of the North, pork. Pork is as Minnesotan as the lakes, trees, and people who call this state home. Did you know there are more than 30,000 pig farming families? They live and work in the North Star State, raising one of the safest, most delicious meats the whole world can enjoy. Pork is something we enjoy in the DeRussia family at least a few times a week. Maybe it's pork loin roast, shoulder, pork chops, ribs, bacon. Oh, I'm getting hungry just talking about it. It's so affordable, too. If you're looking for recipes, MNPork.com's got them. Great recipes like dilled pork cutlets, Parmesan-crusted pork chops, and you can feel good about eating pork from Minnesota farmers. They've been reducing their carbon footprint with better genetics, new technologies, and more. Pick up pork tonight for dinner at your local meat market or grocery store. Let's have Minnesota pork for dinner. Oh, yeah.
DeRussia Eats continues. Here's your host, Jason DeRussia.
DeRussia Eats continuing with Chef Sameh Wadi. World Street Kitchen is his restaurant in a near uptown of Minneapolis. And Milk Jam is the terrific ice cream shop right next door. Saffron was a fine dining restaurant. For many years, I said, Sami, that it was my favorite restaurant in the Twin Cities. And someone asked me the other day what my favorite restaurant is. And man, what a tough question to ask someone who loves eating out. Because it's a tough, I mean, if I asked you, what is your favorite restaurant in the Twin Cities?
I would have to say favorite, like top five, top 10.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's
picking
it. Like,
one.
That's insane.
I don't know. Like, I don't know. And part of me feels like I don't have a favorite. And I sometimes wonder, is that because, I don't know, we were talking the other day about nostalgia, and all sorts of research indicates when it comes to music, age 17 is where people think of as the peak of music. Because where you're at in your life, you can afford to buy music, you can afford to go to concerts, and it's sort of like you still have the innocence of youth, and like, that's your zone. And so I think about that with restaurants, like back when Saffron was roaring, when Tim Niver was doing the strip club in St. Paul, like those were sort of my spots. And now I think, I wonder, have I changed? Has the scene changed? Is it, why is it harder for me to pick the spot today? I don't know.
That's a really amazing analogy and sort of, as soon as you said it, I'm like, yes, I still think the music that I listened to when I was 17 was like
peak
incredible.
TV for people is like age 14 because you're like watching TV with your family, but just old enough where you can have your own taste that maybe mom and dad didn't like. It's just very interesting how we attach to these ages and spots in life.
Look at you teaching things.
Right. But I do
He's
think
not with, just a pretty face.
There's more. There's more. But I do think with food, like similar, if you're someone who loves to eat out, or if you love to travel, there probably is a certain zone in your life where you just like locked in, you know?
Yeah, I think it's, for me, it would be a combination of two things. For one, I think right now we have such incredible restaurants and we're operating at a level that was never available for us, right? Just in general, like the ingredients, the talent, the things of that nature is progressed.
Design,
right?
All of that.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is something about nostalgia and there is something about having less choices that just kind of like connects with a certain time.
Yeah.
For me, one of those restaurants that never left my mind was La Bolvie in Stillwater.
Yeah.
Right, like
that was
that
just
space
before I moved
time,
here, so I never got to go there.
That was such an incredible restaurant, and for me, that was a place, a time, and sort of an energy, and the crew that was behind it. And even with that restaurant moving, it lost some of its charm, even though that it grew into something far more grandiose and big and exciting. And so, I feel like picking a favorite restaurant is a similar thing, where like you have a connection with something at a certain time. And then now there's too many connections.
Too many connections, I'm sort of envious of people who can just answer that question with clarity, because it must be nice to
have
your
spot. What is clarity? What is that? Teach me your ways, sensei.
Yes, as I get older, clarity becomes more elusive, right? No doubt about it. Sami Wadi is our guest. Saffron is the restaurant that he is seeking to reopen. When you try to recapture something that was once there, do you worry that you won't be able to recapture it?
A small part of me does. And I think it's more about like setting expectations of what is it going to be, right? It's not going to be the old restaurant.
Yeah.
It's impossible to recreate those memories, that
and
space.
You've changed too, right?
Absolutely. My style of cooking has changed. I'm a lot more handsome now.
You are very handsome.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I appreciate it. I've been fishing for a compliment since I got here. And, you know, and so I think when I think about my actual personal style of cooking and what I prefer to eat today, it's different than what I ate when I was 23, right?
Lighter or more fish or more beef or what?
I think it's more varied, right? Mm. And I think it's more about like certain celebrations of ingredients. Not that I didn't do that when I was a younger cook, but it was more about like, you know, how much can I pack into one bite.
Yeah.
Like one bite of food.
That was sort of the thing at that time, right? Like, can you do something three ways?
Or correct.
Correct. The more accoutrements on the table, the better you
are.
And
now I'm like, hey, a simply roasted head of cabbage with some yogurt that is flavored with shredded beets and a little bit of dill and roasted garlic and a little bit of olive oil is a perfect bite.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
could be a perfect bite, you know? And so
it'll be different by necessity.
Yeah, by necessity. Yeah. And also I think people's diets and eating habits are different, right? And also now we have access to all these ingredients that I didn't have access to before.
Is that wild?
So I'm freaking out. Like, I'm just so excited about all the options that I get to cook.
How influential in your career do you think that moment was when the Food Network called you, when you had that appearance on Iron Chef against Morimoto? You were
25, something like that. I can't remember.
When it aired, perhaps. But how big of a deal was that?
I still cannot believe that that was something that I went through. Because at the time, this is pre-social media, chefdom, you know, all of that stuff. I can't believe that they reached out and invited me to cook at the show. I still think it was a prank, right? And after that moment, it's like nothing changed. We didn't do anything differently at the restaurant, but people looked at us differently.
Huh.
The perspective that people had of our restaurant was all of a sudden completely different.
And you had sort of a stamp of like, this guy's legit.
Correct. Huh. And at the time, we were just doing the same exact thing. We never changed the menu. We never put a burger on the menu at a time that everybody was opening, you know, gastropubs and, you know, it was pigs galore and all of this. And I'm like, no, we're going to eat, you know, we're going to do Mediterranean food and we're going to do light fare and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And all of a sudden people are like, oh no, actually, like, this has been a favorite restaurant of ours. And the newcomers now are the ones that are getting that stamp of like, oh, this is actually a good restaurant.
Interesting. So it was a big deal in that regard.
It was huge. It was huge.
Yeah.
It was probably the biggest thing to my career at the time. You know, I think now looking back, the biggest thing for my career was opening up my second location, because that like changed me as a chef and as an operator, where I just needed to be. I knew I couldn't be at two places at the same time. So that is the biggest impact on my career within me. But then from the outside sources was definitely Iron Chef.
Sameh Wadi is our guest here on DeRussia Eats. We talked a little bit before the break about my hash brown commentary when World Street Kitchen opened brunch. And it's sort of, I think our listeners might be interested in this. I have always written for magazines, and magazines generally have the approach of, you know, unless it's a big fish, you're not going to write, you'll share like critiques of a restaurant, but you're not going to write a negative review because you only have so many times to talk to the audience. People generally want to know where to go, not where not to go. Newspapers, city pages, and I wish we still had city pages, because I think there is value in someone writing every week, and then you have more latitude to go ahead and be critical.
Mm-hmm.
I was sent to write about brunch, and I think I called it drunk food. And
as if that's a bad thing.
Well, I was trying to say that it was a smart thing from a business standpoint, but as a person who's always considered you to be the, and I would say beyond the state, now my food catalog is much larger. I've had many more dining experiences, and I still have yet to find someone around the country, anywhere I've eaten, that can layer spice in such a sophisticated, interesting way that you can.
I appreciate that.
And so, like, when I had cheesy hash browns on a paper plate, I was pretty pissed.
You know, sometimes you have to go through what's bad to realize what's good.
Mm.
And you've had so many good meals.
Yeah.
That cheesy hash browns on a paper plate is exactly what you needed.
Yeah, probably
point.
So. Probably.
Otherwise, so. You wouldn't understand that you were doing it. Correct.
What a gift. You gave me the gift.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
And
thank
I don't look you. At it as a negative review.
It wasn't. I've gone back and read it. It really wasn't that
it wasn't.
Negative.
No, it wasn't. But I think it was hilarious because you're like, we ordered three things with hash browns on them. And I was like, well, yeah, no shit, Sherlock.
Yeah,
like, what did you expect?
I know, exactly. I do. It was a great learning experience because my editor at the time, Stephanie Marge,
incredible human.
She's amazing. And what she did, and sometimes I think, like, we have a relatively new reviewer at the Star Tribune. What Steph did was she went over my write-up with a fine-tooth comb to make sure there were no factual errors there. Mm-hmm. Because she didn't want there to be something where people could grab onto and then dismiss the entire thing, mm-hmm. which was such a learning experience for me because I see it in other food writers or food critics all the time.
All the time.
Where they make a couple factual errors.
Yep.
I once wrote a review of Restaurant Alma, and we both love Alex Roberts. Restaurant Alma is a terrific restaurant.
Incredible.
But before they remodeled it, it felt dated. And I started my review by talking about how they were playing 10,000 Maniacs over, like, the speaker, you know, over the sound system in the restaurant. And, the room felt dated, and they were playing Natalie Merchant. And
who is Natalie Merchant?
Right. Yeah, exactly. This is like me in college.
You just aged yourself.
You were in America at that time.
I wasn't even born at the time.
Alex, after the fact, was like, I immediately called my manager and was like, why are we playing 10,000 Maniacs? And he said the manager denied it up and down and said that DeRussia must have been wrong. And Alex told the manager to, like, go look. And sure enough, I was correct. Thank goodness. But when he started telling this story, I'm like, oh, no.
Amazing.
Like, but just a little detail like that, if you were wrong, it does give, I think, people permission to say, well, how can I trust any of this?
There's been multiple reviews of World Street Kitchen when we had the lamb belly rice bowl on the menu where they would say the pork belly rice bowl. And I just go, if you can't tell the difference between pork belly and lamb belly, you shouldn't be writing in your reviews.
Yeah.
Or actually writing or actually eating, or you should just be
Instagramming, just stop.
Nothing. Yeah. Yes. You should just be at home by yourself in a dark room and just.
Is it hard to take, negative feedback? You've got Yelpers, you've got Instagram. I mean, there's so many ways to give feedback to a restaurant now.
I think there's a fine balance of, like, negative feedback and actual, like, real positive feedback. I think some people just want to be argumentative for the sake of it, and some people actually have had a bad experience and or something that could be improved. And I think from my perspective, I read it and I try to figure out whether or not they fall into one of the two categories.
Are you pretty good at telling, you think?
Sometimes, yes. Other times, it's like it's a very personal thing. And when there's a personal sort of thing that gets put into it, like if you don't like hash browns and you ordered hash browns,
it's on you.
I don't know what to tell you.
Right.
You know, if you don't like, you know, chocolate and you ordered the chocolate ice cream, like, you're just not going to like it. It's not delicious. Yeah.
There's nothing fixable.
There's
about
nothing fixable about it.
But sometimes
I thought that maybe this is different, you know?
But sometimes people do give feedback where you're like, you know what? Like,
this is great.
This person might be right.
Absolutely. Yeah. All the time. All the time. I think that's like
it's
being
hard to
confident.
Be open to that in life.
Yeah,
right?
Just being confident in yourself and in your team, and just, you know, being honest, right? Like, that's, I can improve. Is this an improvement that I want to make or not want to make? That's the second question that I asked myself.
That's really useful for everybody to think about, no matter what your field is.
I think that
is, yeah.
Because sometimes it's like, yeah, I want to get better at it. But in order to do that thing better, it's going to affect, a sort of a domino effect of things that just make it just cost prohibitive or just realistic. Or at that point, like, why do it? But I do like it.
Yeah.
It's a good point.
Makes sense. Sameh Wadi is our guest. We'll break. We'll come back with more conversation here on DeRussia Eats.
DeRussia Eats continues. Here's your host, Jason DeRussia.
Last segment on DeRussia Eats, the podcast with Chef Sameh Wadi, who is getting ready to open up Saffron, a restaurant he first opened up 18 years ago, had a great run, closed 8 years ago. You went down, you know, and you have a great life. You have a great two concepts that are open, World Street Kitchen, and Milk Jam Creamery. Is there expansion plans for those two?
Absolutely. We're in the process of expanding the production facility at Milk Jam right now, so we can do more partnerships with grocery stores and things of that nature, and then a second or third location, hopefully.
Are you surprised like how willing people are to spend $11-$12 pint for ice cream?
No, it should be more expensive.
Because the ingredients?
Because of the ingredients. Because
But it's ice cream. Because people are so... Because you grew up going to the grocery store and you can get the like half quart or whatever they sell it in now for $6.
Yeah. And did you look at the ingredient list?
It's good for my health to not look. No, of course there's a
because
difference. When you first opened, I was concerned. I'm like, are people down for that on a regular basis?
Absolutely.
And it turns out they absolutely are.
There's room in our culinary field for fast food chains.
Yes.
And then there's room for fine dining restaurants.
What's your favorite fast food chain?
Culver's. Everybody knows this.
Yeah.
This is, why would you even ask? I'm so offended right now that you even asked this question.
Well, sometimes I ask for the listener, you know.
I mean, you should have told everybody what I love.
Culver's.
It's a double with cheese, and then you grab the fried shrimp, and then you make a surf and turf. Of course,
that's
you knew this.
Yeah, I did.
Did you not know this?
I did know this.
Okay.
Yes. I did. You also like,
Panda Express. That thick little panda. I love it so much.
Yeah, which is sort of embarrassing for you, I think.
No, actually, it's not. When was the last time you had Panda Express?
It's probably been a while.
Well, you need to take your wife
All right.
out
I
on
mean,
a
you're
proper
right.
date. But, okay, let me just say, you need to go to the Southdale location.
The location matters.
Absolutely matters.
And what is your order at Panda Express?
Ooh, I'm about to embarrass myself.
No.
I do the smorgasbord where I just go, I'll do the three entree.
Yeah.
But then can you give me like two half portions?
Mm.
And then they do that. And then I get a little bit of everything.
Favorite?
Half fried rice, half noodles, and always get the power greens.
What is the like food or dining out trend that you wish would go away?
I don't know.
There's nothing really.
In my mind, I can't think of it. Boring food, I guess.
Are you sort of over? There was a phase where I think a lot of us were enjoying these like 2-3 hour tasting experiences.
Is that a thing anymore?
Not really.
Okay.
There are a handful of them.
Thank God. Yeah. I mean, like, let's not even talk about that because
food,
I mean, there's a time and a place for food that takes 2 to 3 hours.
The art of food,
you will. Yeah, absolutely. But like, I would rather do that at home with some friends and family and just have the conversation and the food is a part of the continuation of the evening.
Yeah.
And it's a star in certain moments, but then I want to like catch up with people. I'm old now. That's what old people talk like.
You know, I want to catch up.
I just want to catch up. You know. I want to see how you're doing. How are you? What have you been up to? How's your knee surgery?
Tell me about your aches and pains.
I mean, my back right now is hurting a little bit, but also like my shoulder on the right, like there's a knot. Can you help me with it later?
Maybe. You know, you spend a lot of time at the gym now. Are you going to be able to still do that when it's time to open the restaurant again? You're going to have to be at Saffron. That'll be a little different from running the fast cat. Not that you're not at World Street or Milk Jam, but it's less
Same
absolutely intensive.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm so lucky at World Street to have the staff, the team behind the management team that has been with me for a really long time. They understand it. They get it. They cook in similar vein that I do. So I love that we've been able to cultivate that environment.
Yeah.
And at Saffron, even towards the end of it, we did have that same kind of energy. But in the beginning, it's going to be a lot of hands-on, a lot of teaching.
Get it up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have a location yet?
There's a couple of places that are floating around, and I just want, you know, I took a really long time. Obviously, 8 years is a really long time to like reopen a restaurant. I just want to make sure that it's the perfect partnership. If I'm going to be somewhere, I want to be there for a really long time, and I want to be in a place that I can recreate those memories that we help create at the first original location. There was something special about that.
You've traveled a fair amount over the last couple of years. When you look at the food scene around the country, and people can listen to this from wherever, how do you feel We have grown, or have we regressed, or how do you feel about Minnesota, the Twin Cities, as a food scene?
I think we've blown up in terms of our like the magnitude of different ethnic background chefs that are coming in and just celebrating their ethnicity and their home country's cuisines and things of that nature. And people are supporting them, which I absolutely love.
Yeah.
To hear that these restaurants are busy day in and day out, it just makes me so happy, because it's very easy to just fall back and just say, okay, I'm going to put a burger on the menu. I'm just going to make this really easy and just, you know, count checks. But that's not what we're doing for the large part. The large majority of restaurateurs want to do something that's special, and hopefully that they can stay in the game for a really long time.
Will the new Saffron have a burger?
Absolutely. On the happy hour menu, like per usual. The bar burger,
I don't know if you remember.
The Sharmula burger, those were really good. And,
but the main menu.
The main menu will not. No. But the bar, absolutely. Who doesn't love a burger?
Everyone loves burgers.
Everyone.
I mean.
Even vegetarians.
Even, they won't tell you.
But.
We know the truth.
We know it. We see you eating the burgers in the corner.
You don't have to confess your sins to us. It's all good. Before we wrap this up, I do want to ask you about how vocal you've been on social media, pro-Palestine. Did you, you know, we talked a little bit about your roots, your family heritage. Did you worry at all about being outspoken on social media, or was the business concern? There was a time when you ran a restaurant that people were really nervous about ever expressing any sort of controversial opinion because you worried you'd tick off potential customers.
I'm more worried that that's a question that's being asked right now. That's the thing that worries me the most, is the fact that we have to say that, is this an issue? I think, if we're being honest, like, this is a non-issue. Like, standing for human rights shouldn't be a big deal. It shouldn't be looked at as a controversial identity, or like a something that is not normal. That's where I think, like, the part of the problem is that, you know, people make a bigger deal out of things than what they really are. You see something wrong, you usually want to do something about it.
I don't know that that was a common viewpoint until the last maybe 10 years.
I would agree with that. And I think social media also was not as big.
Yeah.
Maybe previously to that.
That's very interesting, because maybe you did speak out, but you didn't
always
have,
I mean, you didn't have
a megaphone.
Correct. I mean, and right now... I mean, when people ask me, like, they're like, are you reopening Saffron because of what's happening? I'm like, that is the dumbest question.
Ooh,
yeah, that is the dumbest question you could ask somebody. Like, you want to dedicate 10 more years of your life towards a restaurant and working, you know, 100 hours a week because of what's happening in another country? Like, you are so out of touch with what's happening and what restaurants are. And you don't know who I am as a person.
Yeah.
From the minute that we opened Saffron, it was a political statement. We opened a Middle Eastern-leaning restaurant that served Palestinian dishes. I mean, that alone, people would come in that were anti-Palestinian, and they would have a problem with the fact that I had Palestinian olive oil on the menu. Or people would come in and be like, where's Palestine? You know, and they just want to pick a fight or something of that nature. And our servers were very well versed on how to deal with idiots.
Yeah.
And so
how interesting. That never would have crossed my mind.
Oh,
like,
God,
why wouldn't you want a chef to, like, express his personality and soul and roots in food?
Because we know certain people just are not that comfortable with themselves.
Yeah. Because it's no threat, no matter what anybody thinks about anything.
Correct.
Like, it's really, I go to your restaurant to see your point of view.
Absolutely. And share the food.
And like, share the food.
Yeah. And one of the most popular dishes on the Saffron Mezze menu was my grandmother's slow-cooked green beans.
Yeah.
You know, where on the menu said slow-cooked green beans in the style of my Palestinian grandmother. And
that was a conscious choice.
That was an absolute conscious choice, because my grandmother when you're reading the menu may mean something different to you as to somebody that comes from Palestine, as to somebody that comes from Southeast Asia, right? And so for me, it was putting a time and a place and an energy in on this dish that also came from my roots. And saying my Palestinian grandmother reiterated that I come from those roots. I may not be born there, but that doesn't make me less Palestinian.
It's really powerful, you know? One dish, one item on a menu. But the reality is, for plenty of people in Minnesota, especially at the time you opened up, that may have been their first exposure to like any sort of connection with a Palestinian.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was, you know, it was an overcooked plate of green beans, right? Like, yeah. That is the part that is absolutely mind-boggling for me, is like conceptually everybody should have hated it, but it was so popular and it was super delicious that it became one of our like most popular dishes. And yes, that will be coming back on the menu with this new iteration of saffron.
I can't wait. I can't wait. I've been fortunate enough to taste your food over the last several years while you were doing some in-home dinners and some of those experiences. And I just, you know, I've always loved your food, and it's your soul and your story that I don't know if you can ever disconnect it, right? You can't say like, I love this person, I love the soul, because you as a person, you can taste it.
I really appreciate that. Yeah. For me, it's cooking that comes from the heart. And
I know to some people that sounds like nonsense. Like, what do you mean? Like, cooking is cooking. But I really think you can feel the soul. And there are some restaurants where you have the food and you're like, man, this is technically delicious, but I can't understand why I'm not connecting with it.
It's soulless. There's a lot of soulless food there. Yeah, yeah. And I would rather have a plate of soulfully cooked food with love. We have this concept that's called nefes in Mediterranean or Middle Eastern cooking, like Arabic food. Nefes means breath, which literally is the breath that you breathe into the pot as you're cooking the food.
Huh.
That concept, the nefes, the breath that you breathe into the dish, is what makes food delicious. Because a recipe that's cooked with a person that has nefes and a person that doesn't have nefes is not going to taste the same.
Man, that extends way beyond the kitchen. That extends whatever you're doing. How does your breath, how does your nefes impact? All right. Yes. I'm going to sit with that.
Sit with it, yeah. But think about it. Like, you cook a dish that I give you a recipe to, and my crispity chicken is a perfect example.
Yeah.
Like, if you cook it versus your much more, you know, talented and beautiful wife cooks it, we know who's going to.
We know which will taste better.
We already know.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, she has a soul.
And you're on the radio.
And I'm on the radio. Sameh Wadi, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This was a joy. Thanks so much for listening to the DeRussia Eats podcast on WCCO Radio, 830 AM. We do conversations with chefs, with farmers, with small business people every Tuesday and Thursday at 4 p.m. The podcast is available every week. If you enjoyed what you heard, I would love for you to leave us a review. Give us however many stars you can. I don't know, 10, 20 stars would be nice, 5 stars. And leave your feedback as well. It really helps us grow and helps support covering the food community here at WCCO Radio and in the DeRussia Eats podcast. If you'd like to email me with an idea or a question about the restaurant scene, you can email Jason at Odyssey, AudacyAudacy.com. Jason at Odyssey.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on the DeRussia Eats podcast.
Thanks for listening to DeRussia Eats. Dan Cook is our producer. Jason DeRussia is your host. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review. DeRussia Eats is a production of Odyssey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
On my podcast, A Spy with Emma Greed, we share the keys to succeed in business and in life. Listen to and follow A Spy with Emma Greed and Audacy Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.